Time now on Siren Radio for another edition of Business Matters.
Don't talk, just hold me closer. Let me sit on top of your knee. Go ahead and take care of business for me, for me.
Our special guest for the latest edition of Business Matters, of course, keeps us in a kind of health zone because we're delighted to welcome the director of Lynx Therapy Limited to the program, psychotherapist, of course, Brian Pope. How are you, Brian?
I'm good, thank you, Alex. Lovely to be here.
Excellent. Great to connect with your good self. And I suppose you could say that many businesses need to have some psychotherapy just to help them relax after the crazy world they've been experiencing over the last few years. Was that part of the rationale for setting up the joys of your company in Cleethorpes?
That's a good question. I think you're right. Many businesses, mental health is, I think, becoming more prominent and more awareness of. Initially, when I set the company up, it was actually to explore, it really to provide professional level services alongside NHS services. So my background's in the NHS, and became frustrated about 10, 15 years ago with the ability to provide services and also the ability to innovate. So that was the fundamental motivation for setting it up.
The mind is a very powerful aspect of our personality. It's very, very much rooted in that. Psychology as a science emerged just obviously from the challenges of Freud, right the way through Jung, through a whole variety of other things. What first led you into psychotherapy and psychology in particular as a route for your own career?
It was an accident, Alex. I was a young man, and I traveled a lot, and I sort of went all around the world, and I needed to get a job because I'd actually run out of money, and the only job that was available was in a secure unit in a psychiatric facility. So it was as simple as that, actually.
So no grand plan, no grand scheme that you actually were interested from a young age?
Just real world stuff, I think.
And again, that's a really interesting set of things, because I know that there'll be listeners to this program who might say, oh, yes, social sciences, psychology, psychotherapy, etc. It's all woo-woo and various other aspects. We talk Reiki, we talk healing practices, etc. I mean, I think, sadly, that still is a mindset that tends to still exist. I mean, we here we are, third decade of the 21st century. Do you still find that there's a certain skepticism in terms of the services that you actually offer?
That's a complex question. So straightforwardly, the lack of ability to provide mental health services within the NHS comprehensively has led to really an unregulated market, or the wellness market. And so people are trying to find solutions to problems within a complex marketplace. And it naturally leads to frustration if people aren't getting sort of properly accredited services, I think. More broadly than that, I think there's a shift a big time shift actually in psychology into more measurable services. So one of the problems with, as you indicate, really, psychology is where is it? You know, what are we actually talking about? I see somebody, I ask them, how are they? And they say, I feel terrible. What does that mean? So it's crucially important to the individual. But psychology big time, and particularly one of the areas we work in, is towards much more measurable psychological input, and particularly the connection between sort of mental experience, psychological experience, and the body, which are completely integrated, really, in my experience.
I think it was the philosopher Gilbert Ryle who started talking about mind-body experiences and the whole diversification. Actually, you can probably go back to the ancient Greeks as well, because they had a few things to say about it as well. I'm interested that Lynx Therapy, of course, on your website, which is lynxtherapy.org, we have Lynx Therapy offers modern psychological services. How modern is modern? I mean, because I alluded to obviously Freud, and he's kind of been disconnected over the last few years, basically. There are a lot of psychologists who say, oh, we're in a completely different market now. So where philosophically does Lynx Therapy effectively root itself?
In science, I think. Alex, and what's and you know, so as an accredited psychological therapist, being BCP accredited therapist, I have to follow what are called NICE guidelines, National Institute for Clinical Excellence guidelines. What that routinely does, regularly does, is review evidence of what's effective. But that's a constantly moving feast. To work constructively with somebody, there has to be some kind of scientific evidence base of what works and what doesn't.
The recent pandemic raised a number of issues, still continues to raise a number of issues in terms of the way people cope with aspects such as isolation, aspects such as just generally getting through life, etc. And certainly it would seem that in education, and this is affecting all levels, really, the number of cases of mental ill health seem to be increasing exponentially. Is that just a product of the times that we're living in? Is it a case of there's something else that has its work here, or is it actually a good sign that people are, at least certainly in Britain, getting away from the stiff upper lip mentality that basically said, oh, we'll just carry on. That's all we do. Keep on carrying on.
I think that's right, Alex. I think society's changed now. I think people are more aware of, say, their emotional experience. And the difficult, and certainly in the scientific term, in psychotherapy, the impact of not dealing effectively with emotional experience and the impact that can have. And so I think it's just, society, people are able to express themselves more in one sense. But I think it also is fashionable, so having mental health problems in some areas can actually be fashionable now. Particularly in some of the generation, a younger generation of people I work with, if I give you a practical example, in a local school, it's actually fashionable to be diagnosed with ADHD. So there's actually, it's like some of these mental health stigma issues are almost become like a badge of honour in some ways as an explanation, and people use that to achieve their own goals. That's not a criticism. That's actually an adaptive function of how people are operating in our rather extraordinary society at the moment.
There are, of course, precedents. I mean, the notion that back in the 80s, I recall dyslexia being treated with an awful lot of scepticism. It was not identified as a genuine issue. It was often regarded as, oh, it's just a middle-class badge of honour, as you said, referring to ADHD, etc. We can go even further back, of course, to post-traumatic stress disorder, and how 100 or so years ago, if people were actually suffering shell shock, they would have been effectively executed or branded as a coward, etc. So, progress has been made in those areas. Do you feel as though the balance is being reached, or is it a case of it's an ever-going process?
I think it's probably an ever-going process, I think. I think, what we've got is, in general, people are trying to do the best they can. I'm not critical of the NHS. I think it's got a hugely challenging sort of remit, and people within that kind of structure are doing the best they can. But also the challenges of our society are very powerful at the moment. I think the financial pressures and the pressures to achieve, etc., are so powerful that they're putting stress on people. And so I think that I think language is important in this kind of area. So the diagnostic criteria approach of people who've got anxiety, depression, etc., has got its limitations. And I think different ways and different languages of trying to relate to these problems are actually coming out now. So we tend to use language more of stress and trauma, and that provides often a language that people can connect with more effectively. Whereas if they're being labelled into something like PTSD or something, we use those criteria ourselves, but actually the impact on the individual can be different.
Doom scrolling, one of those lines that I've talked about with students frequently, whereby social media provides you with the opportunity, if you so choose, to effectively have negative story after negative story after negative story after negative story and so on, hence the term doom scrolling. Is this something which sufficient is being done to recognize the issues with respect to the new technologies, or is it still a case of we still don't quite know the kind of impact it's having on our young people as well? Or is it again something which basically we used to say, well, just don't watch the news, but that's easier said than done these days in terms of ways in which you cope with the almost torrential barrage of negativity that we tend to be faced with?
So avoidance is a key issue in mental health, and so it has a direct impact on our nervous system. It's a threat processing response. So from a psychotherapeutic perspective, the question would be asked, why are we doing that? Why is that person doing that? And then I think the second question, also the second inference there, would actually be there's no one size fits all. So because one person is doing the same, similar people are doing the same behaviors, it doesn't actually follow that they're actually achieving the same goal. But avoidance, I think, of negative stimuli, threats, can lead into these kind of patterns of behavior through an avoidance. And that fundamentally drives a longer term problem, which leads into anxiety, emotional disorders, fundamentally. But that's a general comment rather than a specific comment for individuals.
You spoke earlier about how certain mental challenges have become fashionable. Is that helped by the likes of Prince William, obviously speaking out in terms of mental health, and indeed his brother Prince Harry about his issues with respect to his whole life journey? Is that something which, again, we need to be constantly encouraging people to be more open, or sometimes, again, emotional openness can actually lead to scenarios that maybe people weren't expecting?
So again, I think one size doesn't fit all. Many people, including myself, our relationship from inside ourselves with the outside world creates ways we interact. So often the outside world looks very different to what we're experiencing internally. So I think public figures actually saying they've had problems can be hugely beneficial. It can sort of normalise, in a sense, for a range of individuals that they're struggling, and if that can lead them to ask for help or to explore, what's going on there, that can be only hugely beneficial.
Let's talk a little bit more broadly about the kind of clientele who can be served by Lynx Therapy and so on. I mean, over the years, one's encountered everything from problems within the farming industry, within the rural community, farmers actually literally at their wit's end in terms of how they can cope, and clearly the business world itself can have its own challenges and so on. Is there a kind of profile for somebody who sort of comes, or is it a case of, well, mental illness is something which literally can impact anybody at any time and any place?
I think that's true. I think it's a second. I think mostly what the people that come to Lynx Therapy are stressed. And so, the stress model is fairly well established, I think. If you and I were sort of living 10,000 years ago, and we actually live in a cave, and we get on all right. Our systems are balanced. We've got enough to eat, etc. So we're quite balanced, settled in that way. And then we go out, and then suddenly there's a threat. There's like a lion. We've never confronted this before. And so our system sort of reacts to that. It's in evolutionary terms, we're designed to react to that. So our heart beats more quickly. We tend to sweat, or, you know, it varies a bit between individuals. But we're really preparing ourselves to actually sort of deal with that threat. And then, you know, I'm not too much of a fighter. So, you know, we say both of us run away and we actually get away from the threat. We go back to, into the we get back into the cave. There's no way the lion can find us again. And so our system goes back to normal. So this is the way in evolutionary terms that our autonomic nervous system, our threat processing is designed to work. As we sort of move forward in time, we, you know, perhaps 5,000 years later, I'm sat in the cave. And my cognitive abilities are starting to develop. And so, you know, I start to think things like, that lion, that was really nasty. What if it came to get me, say? And, you know, and so I'm starting to what if here. So my negative thought processes are getting taking over. Now, my threat processing can't really deal with that. It can't differentiate. So clearly it's got a different language between there actually being a threat there and then me starting to think all these negative thoughts. The consequence is, though, my autonomic nervous system, particularly my threat processing, goes on, and then it's got a different characteristic in that it doesn't tend to resolve itself because I'm developing this pattern of tending to churn things over. And so this becomes to the second level of the stress model. Now, we can act for long periods of time like that. You know, as human beings, we're incredibly resilient. And so many of us would be able to sort of think and, you know, operate in that kind of way. But that system, the autonomic nervous system, connects to loads of other systems in our body. So it's actually connecting to our blood, you know, the way we pump blood around our body, our immune system. So eventually the body starts to react to that, or the brain starts to react to it. So we start to feel much more uncomfortable. And at that level, it's still reversible with help. But actually the risk there is increasing dramatically in health terms, in that something's likely to break. And so at that point, we then start to transition into much more longer term problems, or people will go to a GP or something like that, be diagnosed with anxiety and depression, whereas actually the underlying cause is actually this process, the way we're actually dealing with threat. Now, if you then run that forward into modern day, there's threat everywhere. We're actually, you know, there's wars, there's COVID, there's so externally we've got the pressures at universities, etc., to achieve things, new groupings, all these things can be processed as threats. But if that becomes too established in our experience, then, you know, it becomes unhealthy for us and can lead to longer term consequences.
In the day, I seem to recall healthy mind, healthy body was a maxim that was used many times by British public schools and so on. Is that something which, although it seems a very pithy, very basic phrase, ultimately it's at the heart of psychotherapy, that actually, you know, as you've alluded to, if we do actually get constantly impacted by stress, it will, despite our best efforts, ultimately end up manifesting in terms of physical ailments as well?
I think that's true. But I think so. The fundamental basis of therapy is in that. I think is so the whole mode really of services in sort of mental health in the UK has now shifted really to individuals taking responsibility for their own health and then actually trying to work out with assistance, you know, what's actually going on and what can I do to help in that kind of good situation. I think one of the easiest way, perhaps, Alex, to see this is an example I often use with clients when I start to see them. So if, you know, where this clinic is, just along the road there's a Costa coffee shop. It could be any coffee shop. And we go, you and I go into the coffee shop twice. And when we go into the coffee shop, everything is identical both times. The only thing that's different is the first time we go into the coffee shop, my threat processing system is in balance. The second time we go into the coffee shop, the threat processing is activated. My sympathetic nervous system is activated. So you and I go into the coffee shop and you're talking to me and my attention is focused on what you're saying. So I'm listening to what you're saying. I may agree with it. I may not agree with it. But the focus of my attention is on what you're saying. There's a cup of coffee there, and I've got a balanced appraisal of it. It's too hot, it's too cold, or I like it, you know, I like that particular kind of comic. I've got this positive, the opportunity of a positive emotional connection with it. When the barista bangs his coffee machine, something on, you know, it makes that loud noise, I hear that as part of the ambiance of being in the coffee shop. I actually, you know, if it just feels natural, you know, I may like it or I may not like it, that kind of experience, but that's the kind of experience. And so then when we leave, you know, we'd spent some time together. Oh, it was nice to meet Alex. Or we didn't really have anything in common. You know, perhaps we'll meet again. I've got this kind of balanced appraisal of the situation. Second time I go into the coffee shop, I'm already uncomfortable as I go in because my threat processing is active. So if you're talking to me, it's very difficult for me to focus on what you're saying because I'm my attention is scattered because it's scanning for threats. If I can become aware of the coffee cup, you know, everything about me wants to get away. If I can become aware of the coffee cup, and then the one thing that's switched off in evolutionary terms with the threat is positive feeling. So as I look at the coffee, all I'm going to come up with is negative appraisals of it, or possibly neutral appraisals of it, or I'm just going to avoid it. I don't particularly want to go there. When the barista bangs and makes a loud noise, what it does is it activates a thing called my startle reflex. I say, well, what was that? I've got to, you know, I've just got to get away. Where's the threat? Everything about me is trying to sort of engage with that kind of experience to keep me safe. So if I can stay to the end of it, the time together, all I'm going to come up is, well, that was a waste of time. We didn't have anything in common. I've got to come up with this kind of negative appraisal of it. So the interesting thing about that process is actually I'm in the same place. You know, the external experiences are exactly the same. And so many people I work with, like at university level, going into new kind of situation like that, these are the processes that are often working in their experience. And it can be very difficult to see that actually by working constructively, it's possible to shift from that second state to that first state. And then many of the practical issues related to the challenges of, say, being at university, and but also what I've opened up there is the possibility of enjoying things as well as achieving things because my attention is more effectively focused. So in essence, that's really the key principle of psychotherapeutic approaches at the moment. What adds on to that, though, Alex, is actually that's now measurable. So this is the real area where we're working big time at the moment, because one of the big problems with psychotherapy, like as we alluded to before, is, you know, somebody will come in to see me, or will we talk, how do you feel? Or I feel terrible. What does that mean? Now it's possible to measure your autonomic nervous system using a process called heart rate variability monitoring. This is very, very heavily researched. And so that using that stress model of those four levels, as you get up to the sort of second, third and fourth levels, the connection between in health terms increases, poor health terms increases quite dramatically. So there's a lot of correlation between poor heart rate variability and poor long-term health, both psychological and physical.
From a physiological perspective, I often find that just saying breathe can actually seem to be the best advice, even though it might seem a very crass notion that we actually forget how to breathe, or indeed breathe properly and appropriately, and ensure we do actually deal with, as you said, that fear threat response. Is that something in terms of breathing techniques that you think still needs to be encouraged, that people do tend to not just manifest shortness of breath and issues relating to that, but it also can impact the way in which our biochemical systems actually are functioning?
So actually, you're a good interviewer. That's a good. So, in fundamental principles in psychotherapy, and this is a massive problem in our culture at the moment, there's no one size fits all. So, if I say to somebody, and you often see people saying this, if you breathe at a particular ratio, it will help you. That's completely it may help one or two people, it may help, but it doesn't follow that it will actually help everybody. So this is a real problem, because if I'm in that second coffee shop state and somebody says to me, breathing might help, and so, you know, and often it does, just breathing a little bit more deeply and equally can help, but it doesn't follow that that's necessarily true. And so this is why we need objective data. So one of the things we do with people is that we'll actually help them sort of look at their breathing patterns in relation to the feedback on what their nervous system is doing, and then actually try to find particular ratios of breathing which are effective for that person. Now, to be frank, this is a massive risk for people. There's so much information in this void at the moment. And much of that is trying to help people. People have got lots of techniques or things that they've developed. People are trying to make livings, et cetera, in that kind of world. But unless there's some kind of objective feedback process on is it actually helping that person, it can be risky.
And presumably that would also apply to things such as neurolinguistic programming, tapping, all of those areas which have had various levels of popularity over the years in terms of how successful they're being perceived as being.
So I think there's another thread to this, Alex, as well. So, the digital technology is just making the possibility of recording this kind of data much more feasible than it was 10 years, 20 years ago. So things like the Apple Watch development, whether the range of health data that can be recorded is enabling the possibility for individuals to be able to record, to explore that what's happening on this more subconscious level. But the big lack really is how do I do that? How do I sort of work in that kind of area?
You've raised the issue of technology, so let's move on to that. And the ever-present, I won't say threat, although it's been regarded as that, of artificial intelligence, chat GPTs, machines, connections, all of those elements. Is that something which you're finding more people are concerned about? Is it a case of it can be an asset that actually, in 50 years or so from now, we could be having a virtual Brian Pope speaking to a virtual Alex Levchuk, outlining discussions and debates in an area which has been programmed from the algorithms of the data that's been collated about, from us in our lifetimes?
I think we can nearly do that now, Alex, if I'm honest. But actually, let me just come at that a slightly different way, actually. So if I record my heart rate variability, say, and it's in that first coffee shop state, I get a flow pattern, this kind of pattern. So what heart rate variability is measuring is the interval between my heartbeats, which is actually controlled by my autonomic nervous system. So if I'm in a balanced state, I get this kind of flow state. If I'm in a threatened state, I get this chaotic state. So what we're doing at the moment is we're actually simulating in an AI environment that coffee shop experience to work with clients, and then we're actually feeding back to them in real time which of those experiences they're in. And then if they're in real time, if they're actually in an anxious state, say if they're in that elevated state, if they use particular techniques within that coffee shop environment, they're actually then able to adapt their behavior in a safe place for people. This is the key element that's coming into this, is creating safe spaces for people to actually be able to explore these kind of issues. So in that sense, is that good? That you could also apply that kind of approach in a negative way. That's not my world. Some people will do that. But for me, it just feels like to try and help people. And, without any doubt, there's a massive shortage of qualified people who can work in. And then if you add in the combinations of things like the digital technology aspects as well, there's a real shortage. But also within that, there's real opportunities to develop newer kinds of ways to support and help people.
And I suppose the essence of biofeedback comes into action as well, in which we're looking at how, presumably, as with all educators, it's the opportunity to lead out the potential of the individual and to ensure that physicians can heal themselves as well.
Of course. To be frank, I see many people, they're senior executives in the, I see GPs, I see, the stress is applies everywhere at the moment. And, one of the key things when COVID hit, one of the things I specialize in is trauma, and the sort of the conventional wisdom when COVID hit was organizations have gone into trauma. And there's a lot of evidence that the organizations haven't really come out of that trauma yet. in organizational terms.
So, or indeed in governmental terms, but that's another issue for another program entirely. Let's talk a little bit more about the procedures that you adopt, because I do know that you're very keen on sound as a way of actually impacting on people's awareness and so on. And we were doing a feature recently on crunch cancellation technology, which enabled gamers to effectively mute the sound of them eating various foodstuffs whilst actually sort of having their microphone open. I mean, that's one level which has been developed through using AI, actually. In terms of using sound, is that something which, from your own specialism, it's very key to actually ensuring that the senses are engaged, and particularly the sense of hearing, in terms of how we begin to start reflecting on our experiences?
So I think, as an individual, we're a dynamic system. Where there's complexity, extraordinary complexity of conscious and subconscious processing. So, as we sit here I'm listening, I can hear my voice, I can hear your voice, so, and that my middle ear is directly connected to my autonomic nervous system. So, this is just evolutionary in prehistoric terms. If you and I were sort of slithering along in a swamp and we didn't react to that kind of sound instinctively, we'd be dead. We wouldn't have survived. So we've actually got that inside us. And so particular sound thresholds profoundly impact that kind of experience of threat versus relaxation. The key thing is this one size doesn't fit all. So it cannot be assumed that, you and I are going to respond the same way to the sound threshold. So, there are different explanations coming out. Different explorations for things like ADHD diagnosis, particularly in America, where there's a lot of research going on around the impact of sound in those kind of environments and the impact, the way different people react to those kind of sound thresholds. And so if for one person that can be very threatening, and for another person it can be just comfortable. So in social situations, that creates different kinds of experiences. So when we use a particular app to actually explore this in detail, to try and find ways to actually to activate the nervous system through sound processing. And again, this is individual, but for some people, they will actually find a soothing sound. Other people might, like people you were talking about, they may find a more sort of sharper sound can actually have different kinds of impacts in their experience.
How do you relax, Brian? How do you switch off? Because, I mean, we talked about, obviously, adventures from being in the swamp, in the cave, in a coffee shop, all of those kind of hypotheticals. How do you actually unwind at the end of the day?
So I think, I think there's several ways I do that, actually. So one is I've applied these techniques to myself. So over 10, 15 years now, actually, I've sort of explored heart rate variability monitoring. There's a whole range of scientific things under that about the way your breathing can actually impact on how you experience. So that's one level. So I try and do that sort of regularly. And also, the one of the key purposes of that kind of digital monitoring is to see trends. How am I changing? Am I getting more stressed, etc.? I think on another level, I have quite a good fight with the dog. We've got a lovely Tibetan Terrier. He's always really pleased when I get home. And so, we play, and that is expressing the emotional feelings which are actually being tied up during the day.
And there is, of course, a belief that the Tibetan dogs that we actually have now are indeed the reincarnated souls of original Tibetan monks.
That's right.
That's right.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But certainly, for me personally, that helps.
Okay, we're coming to the end of this particular fascinating insight into the work of your good self and Lynx Therapy as well from that point of view. We're about to hopefully listen to something which I know you're going to send over, which is a kind of musical journey from that point of view. Would you like to just share what it is we're about to sort of wrap up this little piece with?
Yeah, sure. So it's difficult to explain some of these concepts, and people learn and listen on different kinds of levels. So for ages, I tried to find ways other than verbally, just trying, so that coffee shop experience, as you transition from sort of stress to sort of balance, And so there's a piece of music that I can share, which really, for me, encapsulates that. It's this transition from like the chaotic kind of noises that are there, then into this more smoother kind of harmony. And so I found that helpful. But also some people I work with, you know, find that kind of an easier way to relate to rather than the sort of, you know, the cognitive things.
Okay, well, we'll hear it in a few moments. Linkstherapy.org, presumably the best place to go to if people wish to find out further details about the work that you do and ways in which they might sort of wish to get in contact.
Yeah, so you know, the easiest way is the email, brian@linkstherapy.org. And we're always open to talk to people. You know, we work with a lot of, as well as seeing clients, we've got, you know, the various projects on at the moment, you know, where we're trying to apply these principles into practice. And we do work with sort of universities, and I've done quite, there's enormous potential for research in these kind of areas at the moment.
Absolutely. And of course, I'm right, you are based in Cleethorpes, is that correct?
That's right. Yes, absolutely.
That's very good. We'll also feature some of the music of Chloe Rose, who, of course, is one of our regular co-hosts and a well-known BBC introducing singer who'll be performing, I think, on November the 25th, live at the university. So it's Chloe Rose coming up in a few moments. Brian, well, we've got two final closing questions. They're not hugely traumatic, hopefully. But first of all, have you had a reasonably interesting session on this edition of Business Matters? Has it been okay for you?
Yeah, it's good. It's great to have the opportunity to try to get some of these ideas out. I think the key message, in the sense that we try and get, is people do have a choice. They don't actually often see that they've got a choice. People get so overwhelmed by just experience. And just to open up, there are opportunities, there are things that people can do to actually try and resolve these problems, can just help sort of move things forward.
Well, then the next question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again sometime, maybe actually live in the studio or certainly by the medium of Zoom? Will you come back?
Yeah, very happy to. I think, you know, very much wanted to try and get this out into the ether now and sort of explore the issues with people.
Brian Pope, director of Lynx Therapy, huge thanks. And we will prepare to listen to some wonderful, authentic music.
Nice to see you, Alex. Thank you.
Well, we've certainly been focusing on business matters as far as technology is concerned as an underlying theme. And we're delighted now to be able to welcome a master's student from the University of Birmingham who has indeed been selected as a finalist in the Engineers in Business Champion of Champions competition. That's the wonderful Hrushikesh Bagul. How are you, Hrushikesh?
I'm good, Alex. How are you?
Excellent. Okay, now we're doing this little piece shortly after Elon Musk has actually said that artificial intelligence could effectively open up a whole new era, but it's a bit like the genie in the bottle. Once it's out, we don't know where it's going to lead us. And of course, you've now come up with this wonderful innovation that promises to revolutionize retail through robotics, which is why, of course, you've been shortlisted for a prestigious national award. So would you like to tell us about how you came up with this idea and what indeed the idea actually is?
Yeah, so we realized that retail space is struggling today because of high inflation, because of high labor cost, high operational cost. The margin the retail operates at is already thin. And because of all these problems, it has become laser thin. So they need a technology for the future. They need a technology to survive and compete against online businesses. Mm. So we provide this technology to the retail businesses. So it's an AI robotics technology, which completely autonomizes the entire shop. The entire picking and packing of the order is taken care of by the robots. And this technology helps retail reduce their operational cost and their initial investment in the by reducing the cost of space and labor cost.
Now, clearly, as you just outlined it, this is technology that enables stores to operate 24/7, 365 or 366 days a year without human involvement, making sure that essential supplies are accessible to customers around the clock. But who determines what's an essential supply? Can we not actually just transfer this to all supplies?
So currently, our target is to focus the essential supplies like pharmacies and convenience stores. But surely it can be then converted to all types of retails and all types of supplies.
Okay, now again, these are autonomous dot stores designed to bridge gaps in accessibility and again, ensuring that everyone can obtain groceries and medications anytime, anywhere. It sounds fabulous, but equally, are you aware of the fact that there are a number of people who might be listening to this who will think, this is a nightmare, the machines are taking over, how are we going to cope?
Yeah, of course, there are people who think like that, but the thing is, we want humans to do work which is non-repetitive. We are replacing only the things that are non-repetitive, and we want to save time of humans. We want humans to work in a daytime rather than in the night shifts and all. So this technology is going to revolutionize it in a way that it works with the humans. So not only the autonomous stores, but the semi-autonomous stores, it's going to work with the humans, and it's going to help humans stay away from the repetitive and hard tasks.
Okay, so it basically makes us possibly lazier. But in terms of, say, promoting accessibility, efficiency, and affordability, I'm just interested in terms of how, when we're talking about improving lives, we can see this. Now, it may well be I'm just embracing my inner Luddite here, but can you just share with us in terms of, you know, the fear that comes around from the notion of, well, yes, it transforms businesses, yes, but it makes them less accessible. And we've all had the frustration of having to try to deal with artificial intelligence and, of course, robots when we're looking for those things being packaged.
Yeah. Yeah, people are afraid to the artificial intelligence and robotics, but it's the future and it's going to revolutionize our life in a much better way. Every now and then new technology comes in, like internet in 2000 came in and people were afraid that it will take a job. Computers came in and people were afraid that computers might take up all the job. But eventually it turns out that all these new technologies are helping humans do their jobs in better ways. Accordingly, it's going to help businesses, it's going to help societies, it's going to help us only in the future to get the essential supplies to revolutionize the retail and get our things 24/7 in a easier way, in a convenient way for our society.
Okay. Now, you're pitching this idea, of course, on November 3rd, 2023. So some of our podcast listeners might be able to access this earlier. If you're listening to it as far as our standard programming is concerned, you have to use a time machine. But there's £16,000 up for grabs. This obviously will help you with seed money to help you develop your innovation. I mean, clearly, we hope you do the business and actually succeed, Rishikesh, because obviously we're rooting for you as our special guest from this point of view. But is there backup for dot stores or autonomous dot stores if you don't manage to succeed with respect to this particular entry? And for which, obviously, congratulations for having reached the final stages in the first place.
Yeah, thank you for that. So I have a backup plan. So we are planning to start our first semi-autonomous pharmacy store in Greenwich. We are in talk with the one of the owner in Greenwich who is interested to partner with us and start the first semi-autonomous store in Greenwich. So we are planning to start that by the end of first quarter of the next year. And based on the response, based on how much ROI we can improve for the pharmacy, we'll take it from there and see how we can expand across the UK.
Now, clearly, after taking part in this University of Birmingham Enterprise Enter competition to start off with, of course, which led you to become one of the champion of champions from this side of things, I think you're quite keen to actually alert the notion or alert prospective students and graduate engineers to enhance their business skills. Would you say it's important to actually ensure that graduates across the engineering world do actually have some business savvy to effectively take to the market?
Yeah, definitely. All the entrepreneurship skills, all these business skills are really necessary for all the engineers because it gives them the different perspective of looking at the problems. If you are just an engineer, then you look at the problems in a standard way and you try to solve it with the engineering perspective. But if you have the business skill, if you have the entrepreneurship skills, mostly you come up with the out of the box solutions, the unique solution. And that is something that we need to innovate to go further and improve the world step by step.
I mean, I've got to say, I slightly mixed feelings here, Rishikesh. I mean, I think congratulations to the Engineers and Business Champion of Champions final. I'm still a little bit concerned about where we might be heading for this, but maybe that's because I've been influenced too much by bad science fiction writers and concerns about robotics. Maybe I should focus more on the Isaac Asimov routine. Just out of interest, what led you to an interest in engineering? How did you actually decide that engineering was for you?
So I'm very lazy person. I want everything to be done by robots. So it started as when I was very young. It was when I was child. I wanted things to happen automatically, light switches to start automatically, light switches to turn off automatically by voice command or by using mobile phone. So during my childhood ages, I used to break my toys, create something out of it. And that's how I led to the robotics, and that's why I pursued robotics for my undergraduates and my masters, and that's how I got into engineering basically.
And what advice would you give to somebody else who might be listening to this particular interview and feature and is umming and ahhing in terms of whether they should do engineering, first of all, at university, or indeed whether they should actually look to possibly take part in the Engineers in Business event?
Yeah, if you are already in engineering, this is the great opportunity for you to meet other people, brilliant mentors, brilliant jury members. It's great way to validate your idea, great way to network, and it's a great opportunity just to be here. You get lots of business skills that you don't generally learn in engineering schools. So it's a good opportunity, and everyone should participate, I guess.
And for people who wish to follow your success, Rishikesh, how can people actually follow dot stores online or indeed your progress in the Engineers in Business event itself?
So people can follow me on LinkedIn, and we have a website dash.robotics.com. People can follow us there, and we'll be posting our progress there.
Excellent. Well, Hrishikesh Bagul, master student, of course, at the University of Birmingham, and indeed creator of a program that uses autonomous robotics to create around-the-clock retail stores that can operate without human intervention, part of the Engineers in Business Champion of Champions competition this year. Huge thanks, and good luck, Hrishikesh. I take it we can guarantee that you haven't replaced yourself with a robot as yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Not yet, he says. Okay, Hrishikesh, take care. We salute you. See you soon.
Thanks.
Driving, it can be a very pleasant experience depending on the weather conditions. And we've just obviously come out of Storm Babette. And now, of course, we're faced with Storm Kira. Clearly, there would be a classic case of saying, don't drive, but sometimes we have to. And how do we actually cope with that? And how do we ensure that our vehicles are ready to cope with any inclement weather conditions? Well, we're delighted to welcome a truly wonderful individual when she's writing about motoring, when she's a motoring expert. She is the one and only Maria McCarthy. How are you, Maria?
Hello.
Well, great to connect with you as ever, Maria. I suspect you've never had any problems whatsoever in driving in the wet because presumably every time you've actually gone out there, you've checked the tire pressure is okay, brakes are fully functional, etc., etc.
I think that, bad weather conditions, I think they challenge everybody. It's a bit like, people sort of say you need to respect the sea, because it's very powerful. And you also need to respect the road because, if you've got wet conditions, icy conditions, it doesn't matter really, how good a driver you are, you still need to be very careful and you still need to like make sure that your vehicle is in, tip-top condition. And what I feel you need to do is you need to do the powder check. Now, what that is you've got P, which is for petrol, then your other types of fuel, then you've got O, which is like oil, then you've got W, which is water, all the liquids, windscreen wiper fluid, that sort of thing. Then you've got D, which is damage, then you've got E, which is the electrics, and then finally you need to check the R, which is rubber, and that's your windscreen wipers and the tyres. Now, I've been looking at a study commissioned by Halfords and carried out by the Director for Automotive Research at Cardiff University on the effect that worn tyres have got on stopping distances. And what they did was they carried out the research in wet, wintry conditions, like we've been having recently, and it showed that worn tyre tread really significantly reduces the stopping distances. What they did was they set up a comparison between a car with tyres with a tread depth that was low but still legal at 1.6 millimetres. Then they had another vehicle where the tread depth was a good one, that is 4 millimetres. And what they discovered was that the tyre with worn tyres travelling at 60 miles an hour had the same stopping distance as a car with the good tyres travelling at 68 miles an hour. So basically, it's like speeding without realising it. You think you're going at 60, but really, when it comes to stopping distances, you might as well be going at 68 because the worn tyres have got less grip on the road and that makes it more difficult to stop.
Yeah, with 286 flood warnings likely to be issued and yellow weather warnings and so on, this is something which I suspect people might easily be caught out as well by saying, oh, we're just going to drive that 20 or 30 mile distance. And then, of course, a downpour occurs.
Exactly. I think it's really important to be aware of the weather, not just the weather as it's happening when you look out of the window, but I mean, I don't know about your neck of the woods, but where I live, it's been changing really quickly. So, in the morning it can be fine, and then in the afternoon, you find a complete torrential downpour. And we've been having some showers that have been so intense that literally, I just think it's just safest then just to pull in for a little bit and let that very intense shower just blow over because sometimes you can hardly see, through your windscreen. So yeah, I think that, just stay alert about, what the weather might be that day so you can be prepared and know that if it is going to be bad, you can leave more time for your journey because that's the other thing as well. You see, you've got to look after your vehicle, but you've also got to be aware of other road users and sort of the conditions. So basically don't speed, it's like, make sure that you sort of drive in a more cautious way in bad weather, whatever that bad weather might be.
So it was a standard of somebody who regularly takes the journey from Teesside to Lincoln, about 126 miles, that in the recent inclement weather conditions, we were having articulated lorries clearly actually insisting on overtaking, doing a whole range of other things, and cars going out in the outside lane as well, at a rate where almost the visibility was very low. And you just think, this is crazy, you know, it's madness. So presumably your advice of sometimes it's best to actually just pull in and wait until the actual storm has actually cleared could well be the best option.
Exactly. Because I think what the point you've made about spray is really, you know, valid, because I think sometimes you're driving along and you're sort of fine. And then like a big vehicle might go past you and the spray that they throw up, you know, in bad weather is immense. And you have that moment where you think, oh, I can hardly see. So, you know, yes, I mean, like we all know on long journeys, it's important to take breaks. So if it is possible to like, you know, do the old sort of like, you know, stretch your legs and have a sandwich and a coffee break, you know, during the worst bits, then obviously that is ideal.
And presumably also making sure that less than it used to be the case, I think, when we used to sort of say we need to make sure that the car's prepared for winter, but doing that powder test will be important, allowing for the fact that we may well move in the not too distant future to more frosty conditions, shall we say.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, one of the things you're doing when you're doing your test for the tyres. It's interesting because what people have often said is, you say, oh, you know, just take one of those like little 20 pences and you put it in the groove. And then if the depth is greater than the rim of the 20 pence, then you're legal, you know, because it's, you know, 1.6 millimetres. But in actual fact, 1.6 millimetres isn't really enough, because tyre treads, that starts off at like, you know, 8 millimeters when you get like a brand new tire, you know, it's got these deep grooves in it. And then over time, you know, that tire will wear down. And the legal minimum is 1.6, but that was decided back in 1986, you know, when, you know, we still had like, you know, equipment in children's playgrounds that could kill you, basically. So, you know, now I think we need to up our game as far as like, you know, safety is concerned and look at, you know, having, say, looking at 3 millimeters, you know, as a minimum before we look towards changing our tyres. So what I'd advise doing is don't use the 20 pence. Instead, get yourself a proper tyre tread gauge. They're very inexpensive, and use one of those, because that will give you an actual number to let you know what your tread depth is. And so, you know, if as it is going down, you know, you can know when you need something. All right, okay, it's going such a way, and so soon, yeah, I might need new tires, so I can plan and I can budget for those. And if you're somebody who, you know, doesn't really like doing the tests at all, and no shame if you don't, because not everybody's into interacting with their car and lifting up the bonnet and checking the tires, then you can actually go to Halfords and they will give you a tire check completely free of charge.
Fantastic. As you mentioned, obviously access your local branch of Halfords for details with respect to that. Finally, Maria, how can people actually follow your good self and your advice with respect to motoring?
I'm on Twitter at Maria McCarthy 11, and they can also check out Halfords both on Twitter and their website.
Or indeed these days X, as I think Elon Musk likes to refer to it.
I think so you're right. I think I'm behind the times. That's correct.
Maria McCarthy, motoring expert extraordinaire and author. Huge thanks and happy driving, Maria.
Thank you, and to you.